You generally stop unless you're answering a question or finishing the answer to a question, which is perfectly proper. But sometimes we don't stop. We go on, and we go on, and we go on some more. And it's become apparent that there are times when it appears that the court may be favoring one side or the other, or giving one side or the other a greater opportunity to argue his or her argument. And we want to treat everybody fairly. We also want it to appear to be fair. So we're going to try really hard to adhere to the red lights ourselves today. So it's to some degree, it's a little bit of a new drill for us because we haven't always been as careful of them as we should. So now I'll call our case for this afternoon, State v. Smith, 13-12-28. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington, and I represent the State of Wisconsin in this matter. The State asked this Court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision. The State wants this Court to find that the Court of Appeals conducted improper fact-finding by independently reviewing the factual determination of whether Mr. Smith was competent at the time of trial and sentencing. The Court of Appeals also applied the improper standard of review by not affording deference to the post-conviction court's determination that Mr. Smith was competent at the time of trial and sentencing. The Court of Appeals decision refrains from concluding and finding that Mr. Smith was incompetent. It finds instead that there was reason to doubt Mr. Smith's competence and then reverses for a new trial. But if there's a reason to doubt competence, a competency hearing is the correct remedy. And in this case, Mr. Smith was already afforded a competency hearing. The Circuit Court's decision in this case is not clearly erroneous, and there are many reasons why. This Circuit Court initially expressed doubt about whether it could conduct a competency hearing retrospectively. In this case, no one raised the issue of competency at the time of trial and sentencing, and instead it was raised on post-conviction by in the post-conviction motion. But the Circuit Court, like I said, initially expressed doubt about whether it was possible to do so, but then did hold a competency hearing. The court heard testimony from two expert witnesses and the defendant's trial attorney. The Circuit Court needed to determine if Smith was able to understand at the time of trial and sentencing and whether he was able to assist in his defense. It's pretty clear from this record that at all times, relevant times, Mr. Smith is mentally ill, but that's not the end of the discussion. The Circuit Court needed to find whether he was incompetent under the judicial standards of whether he was able to understand and able to assist his attorney. To determine whether a person understands what's going on, the best way to do that, there's no objective way to figure it out. The best way to do that is to interact with the person and to talk to them and to try and figure out if they're understanding. And at the time, Mr. Smith's attorney was someone who did interact with him. He met with him multiple times in preparing for trial and sentencing, and also corresponded with him via letter, and at no point thought that there was any reason to doubt Smith's ability to understand. His attorney also is in the best position to determine whether he was able to assist in his defense. And his attorney testified at the post-conviction hearing that Mr. Smith did assist him. He testified that during voir dire, they passed notes back and forth, and he was able to get assistance from his defendant.
The trial court essentially found Attorney Sargent more credible than the two expert witnesses at the competency hearing?
I do. I believe that the Circuit Court found that based on the fact that these relevant considerations, whether Mr. Smith could understand and assist in his defense at those times, this Circuit Court determined that the person who was able to interact with him at those times was more credible than the experts. The experts have the the training to be able to figure out if someone is mentally ill, but they both testified at that post-conviction hearing that their opinion wasn't as strong as it would be if they were able to talk to him at the relevant time, because that's the best way to determine his ability.
Let me just double back with you. Although it's much more difficult to determine competency after time has passed from the trial, right?
Right.
It can be done. That is, there are hearings after sentencing, maybe after time has passed, to determine anew whether the person was competent at the time of the plea, trial, and sentencing, right?
Right.
So although the trial court, we've had several trial court judges here.
Yes.
The last trial court judge, Judge Borowski, was not happy about the possibility of hindsight as to competency. I think he wound up recognizing it can be done, and it was his job to do it.
I agree.
All right. And what did you say his finding was, or his conclusion?
He found that Smith was competent at the time of trial and sentencing.
And the proceeding was a hearing, right?
He held multiple evidentiary hearings. At the first hearing, the two experts testified, and they ran out of time, so they held another hearing where the attorney testified, and then both parties briefed the issue, and after that, the circuit court made its decision.
So he got procedural due process, right?
Yes.
And the issue is whether his substantive ruling that Mr. Smith was competent, that's what we're reviewing, right?
You're reviewing whether the circuit court properly found that he was competent at the time.
And the Court of Appeals reversed.
The Court of Appeals reversed.
Court,
the
right.
Standard of review for reviewing courts on the decision of whether, or on the finding of whether someone is competent, is whether the finding was clearly erroneous. And in this case, the Court of Appeals initially laid out that it was a clearly erroneous standard, but then farther down in its decision, in paragraph 23, it wrote that it did not owe deference to the post-conviction court's finding because the post-conviction court didn't observe Smith at trial and sentencing. That was a different trial court. And it's the state's position that conclusion, to independently review the evidence, was erroneous because the circuit court, the post-conviction court, to be clear in this case, heard testimony, did not see Smith at the time of trial and sentencing, but heard testimony from multiple witnesses, and that was the court in the best position to determine whether Smith was competent at the time of trial. There were more than one reasonable inference. You know, the two experts testified, well, Dr. Pankowitz testified that Smith was more likely than not incompetent because he didn't go as far as saying that Mr. Smith was incompetent because of this. He felt it was a problem in his decision that he wasn't able to interview Smith at the time of trial, but he drew the conclusion that it was more likely than not incompetent. Dr. Collins testified that Smith was incompetent at the time of trial and sentencing, and then Stephen Sargent testified that he had no reason to doubt Smith's ability to understand and that he was competent at the time. And the post-conviction court heard all that testimony and was able to take all those facts and drew the conclusion based on those facts that Smith was competent to stand trial.
Now, paragraph 23, to which you made reference, of the Court of Appeals, takes the position that Pate and Garfoot and Burge give deference, but it's to the court that observed Smith at trial and sentencing, right?
That That's the position the Court of Appeals takes.
You disagree with that?
I disagree. I think that the reason why Berge and Garfoot say that the reviewing courts apply a clearly erroneous standard is because it's a factual finding. And any factual finding, reviewing courts aren't able to find facts, and any factual finding needs to be reviewed under
What's
that clearly erroneous.
What's the factual erroneous. Finding here?
The finding of whether Smith is competent to stand trial is a factual finding. Under Garfoot and Berge, this court makes it clear that that's not a legal conclusion, that's a factual finding. And by concluding that that Smith was incompetent at the time of trial, the Court of Appeals improperly found that fact.
Well, I read the Court of Appeals, and I think there's a problem because I don't quite understand what the standard of free review is, but it seems to me that if it's a finding of fact, namely a competency, then you look to see if there's evidence that supports that, right?
Correct.
And my understanding of case law generally is that you can look at the evidence that's marshaled by the lower court, but you can also look at the record and see what evidence is there, right?
Correct. You can look at the record, but the reviewing court is not able to choose from competing inferences. The reviewing court has to draw the inference drawn by the lower court as long as there is support for that in the record. And in this case, there was, because Mr. Sargent's testimony clearly stated that Mr. Smith understood him at all times during their representation and that he was able to assist in his defense. And those are the relevant inquiries to determine whether he was competent to stand trial.
Well, what about the use of the jail evidence?
The jail records were used by both experts in drawing their conclusions and in their reports on whether Mr. Smith was competent at the time of trial and sentencing. Those records show that Mr. Smith had mental illness at many times during these proceedings, but they're not directly relevant to the questions of competency as it relates to his ability to stand trial. And those records were relied on by the experts, but they weren't the only reasons the experts drew their conclusions. And both experts acknowledged that their conclusion was not as strong as it would be as if they had been able to sit down and talk face-to-face. Because looking at Smith's interaction with the circuit court that are in the trial transcripts and the sentencing transcript, and looking at the jail records and his interactions with the jailers, is helpful, but it doesn't answer the question. The best evidence in this case that the Court of Appeals relied on was the testimony of the attorney who sat with the defendant.
That the Court of Appeals relied on?
You meant Circuit Court.
Oh, sorry, I meant Circuit Court. Excuse me. Thank you for...
Could I ask, we're reviewing the hearings in 2012 and the decision that came out of that. Is that right?
Yes.
Was Mr. Smith asked point blank whether he was competent at those two hearings?
He was not, and he did not testify at either hearing. After his sentencing at the post-conviction stage, his post-conviction attorney raised the issue of competency, and he was evaluated for his competency to proceed in post-conviction. And at that point, Deborah Collins drew the conclusion that he was not competent to proceed in post-conviction, but that he would regain the ability with treatment. So the time period passed, and they reevaluated him and determined that he was still not competent. And at that point, the circuit court appointed a guardian ad litem to represent his interests at the post-conviction evidentiary hearings, the ones that this court is reviewing. And at that stage, the defendant was not asked directly whether he believed he was competent to proceed.
Is there any dispute as to whether or not the Court of Appeals went outside of the record? You're not asserting that, are you?
No, I'm not asserting the Court of Appeals went outside of the record. What I'm asserting is that the Court of Appeals improperly conducted an independent review of the record rather than searching the record for evidence that supported the circuit court's factual findings instead reviewed the record and drew its own conclusions, and the state's position is that independent review resulted in improper fact-finding and also in applying the wrong standard of review.
You point to paragraph 23 earlier of the Court of Appeals opinion, and it seemed to me, following that, in paragraph 24 also, the same kind of discussion, that in part the concern of the Court of Appeals was in paragraph 24 in the way that the opinion of the experts was rejected. And I'm reading at the end of paragraph 24. If the opinion of experts can be rejected because neither expert interviewed the defendant contemporaneously with the time in question, then there could never be a retrospective determination of incompetence. This is not the law, citing Johnson. That seems to me a real concern that they have here. Do you agree that a retrospective examination is consistent with the law?
I agree that retrospective determinations, while rare, are something that will happen at times. What I disagree with in that paragraph from the Court of Appeals is that the circuit court rejected the expert opinions simply because they didn't interview Mr. Smith at the time of trial and sentencing. Reading the circuit court's decision and reading in the post-conviction court's decision, it decided not that it was rejecting the expert opinions solely for that reason. Instead, it was weighing the evidence, determined that the expert opinions were weaker because they did not have that contemporaneous interview, and that Mr. Sargent's testimony was stronger because he did sit with Mr. Smith multiple times sat with him throughout the trial and met with him before the trial and after, and that it was much more of a credibility determination at the circuit court. I think the Court of Appeals misrepresents what the circuit court relied on when it says that the circuit court rejected those opinions.
It isn't credibility, is it? Isn't it weight? I mean, you know, we have the map. Help me, I might be wrong. But we have the maxim, of course. Credibility is a determination of the trier of fact. But here it's really what weight, not who was telling the truth, but what weight to give to the opinion.
You're right. That's a more accurate way to say it. The circuit court did not believe that the experts were lying or anything like that. The circuit court actually went out of its way in its decision to talk about how much it respected these two experts and respected their ability to draw these conclusions, but also that it respected the experts when they admitted that there was a weakness in their conclusions. And as I said, Dr. Pankowitz did not testify that Mr. Smith was incompetent. He testified that it was more likely than not that he was incompetent and didn't go as far as saying he was definitely incompetent at trial and sentencing. And I believe that that's because of this lack of contemporaneous interactions with the defendant. Because as I said before, to determine whether a defendant is understanding the proceedings and able to assist his attorney, the most relevant way to determine that is to interact with the person. There's no magic way to determine if anyone is understanding what you're saying other than a give and take and making sure that they have appropriate responses to your questions and those sorts of things.
What's the incentive then to have any experts employed and paid for by the county if it's going to be after the fact? Why not just call in the folks that were there at the time and get their opinion? Doesn't your argument set us down a path that may not be a wise path, that is, give very little value to expert opinions because they per se are due less weight because they're after the fact?
Well, I think in this situation, I'm saying that their opinions, the circuit court, after hearing from both sides, determined that their opinions should get less weight than the attorney's opinion. I'm not saying that in every situation that will be the case. I mean, under any different facts, an attorney could say, well, I barely met with my client and I didn't think it. The attorney might not have as strong a position and as persuasive as far as whether his client understood him. And in that case, maybe a circuit court would look at that evidence and determine that the experts were more were owed more weight than the attorney's conclusion. But I think in this case, and importantly in this case, the circuit court found, made those factual findings, and that's the circuit court's role in all of this. And the reviewing courts don't have the ability to substitute their opinions. There's only, they review the circuit court's decision for whether the circuit court's decision was clearly erroneous. And in this case, because of the evidence that was presented to the circuit court, there was factual support for the defendants, for the conclusion that the circuit court drew. And
Ms. Remington, I got the sense from reading the briefs and reading the circuit court and then the court of appeals that there are two standards of review here. One, as to findings of fact, are they clearly erroneous? And the second was that the circuit court or the post-conviction court here had to make a discretionary decision regarding whether this person was competent. And that as to the second decision, that is, was it a discretionary decision, you look to see, one, were the facts okay, so you're back to clearly erroneous, and then two, was there any mistake of law, and three, did the judge make a rational, reasoned a decision based on the facts and the law? Am I right that there was seemed to be two standards of review here?
I believe that in Garfler and Berge, this court says there's only one standard of review, and that is the clearly erroneous standard.
Even to the ultimate decision?
Even to the ultimate decision. Those cases rely on U.S. Supreme Court precedent that, and especially in Berge, this court addressed the question of the standard of review directly, and both parties had presented it. And in that case, determined that even that final legal conclusion, or that final conclusion of whether he's competent, is still reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard.
I think if I understand the briefs right, I agree with you. The standard is clearly erroneous for whether he's competent, because that's a factual finding. But I think where the discretionary discussion came in is whether the court still had perhaps the discretion to order a new trial, even if he was found to be competent at the time of trial. But there was some discussion about a discretionary standard, and whether a court orders a new trial can, in some circumstances, be discretionary, though it certainly is intertwined with competency in this case.
Yes, and in this situation, the circuit court found that he was competent to stand trial and did not make the discretionary determination of whether he should have a new trial. Just affirmed his conviction, and then he appealed.
When the judge had the hearing below, the judge took testimony, heard the parties' arguments, reviewed their briefs, and then reached the conclusion, as I read it, that the judge found the testimony of the trial lawyer more appealing and gave it greater weight than the testimony of the two experts, and then outlined his reasons for doing so. If he would have done the opposite and said, I find the expert's testimony to be deserving of greater weight, and I'm adopting the testimony of the experts more than and over the testimony of the trial lawyer, we'd be stuck with that determination unless it was clearly erroneous, right?
Correct. That would still be the same standard of review, the clearly erroneous.
So when you say the finding of fact was a determination of competency, I'm wondering if the finding of fact is the weight that was attached to the testimony and the testimony that he determined was more appealing and persuasive and relevant for purposes of the legal determination he had to make. And then once he accepted the attorney's testimony over the testimony of the experts, he reached the legal determination regarding competency. Isn't that how you see it?
That's certainly different from how I see it.
I see it, that's one way to look at the factual finding, but the ultimate conclusion of whether the person is competent is still a factual finding. It's not a legal conclusion, and that decision is still reviewed under that clearly erroneous standard. Okay. Even under that situation. So that is a fact that the circuit court found and that the Court of Appeals improperly rejected.
So who had the burden below?
The circuit court placed the burden on the defendant.
Do you think the circuit court was right?
I do. And I think that it's because of the posture of this case. This isn't a post-conviction. This isn't a question of whether he's competent to proceed at post-conviction, in which case you would be operating under the recent standard.
I see your red light is on. Go ahead and have a seat, and if you feel you want to address it more, you can when you stand back up. I don't want to go beyond the time. Thanks.
Okay. Would you prefer I address the question now or later?
Later. Since your red light is on, I think that's the right way to proceed.
When you come back, look at page 19 of your brief, and which talks about discretion, if you would, under B.
Mm-hmm. What?
When you come back.
When you come back.
Okay.
I want you to look at your discussion on page 18 and 19, where you finally wind up saying the circuit court promptly exercised its discretion, which is what I was referring to in my earlier question.
I will. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am John Bosilewski appearing on behalf of Jimmy Lee Smith. I am asking this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, or viewed another way, reverse the decision again of the trial post-conviction court. And I base that on the Court of Appeals' very sound decision. I would address Justice Abraham's question about the dual standards of review, and I think the answer to that is, in a quotation from the Garfoot case that is cited in paragraph 19 of the Court of Appeals' decision, where they note that they will reverse or disturb a finding of the post-conviction court if there was an erroneous exercise of discretion or if the post-conviction court made a decision that was clearly erroneous. So both those standards there are in that quote from the Garfoot case, and I believe both apply here.
Well, tell me how, because I think I get it, and then it disappears, because it seems to me there were two standards. What standard applies to what issues or facts or holdings as you see it?
Well, I believe that the erroneous exercise of discretion standard comes into play with regard to the post-conviction court finding, basically, I'm going to take the word of the person who was there, that is trial counsel, and reject the word of the persons who weren't there at the time of trial, those being the two experts, Dr. Collins and Dr. Penkevich. And I believe such a categorical rejection is contrary to Johnson, which clearly provides for remands for retrospective determinations of competency. So I believe the court made an error of law which renders the decision an erroneous exercise of discretion.
So what was the error of law?
I beg your pardon?
What was the error of law?
The error of law is applying a methodology that precludes a retrospective determination of competency by categorically taking the word of trial counsel who was present at trial and sentencing and rejecting anyone who, despite whatever positives of their testimony otherwise, weren't there.
I got it. All right.
With respect to the clearly erroneous standard, I think counsel for the state indicated that the ultimate question of competence is a question of fact, and I'm not sure I agree with that. It seems like more of an ultimate conclusion of fact, which is akin to a factual finding, but it basically is based on a conglomeration of all the underlying found facts, historical facts. To guide the court in determining whether a decision is clearly erroneous, I guess you start with the standard set forth in the statute, 805.17 sub 2, which states that a court on appeal can't set aside facts unless they're clearly erroneous, and also instructs to give due regard to the trial court's credibility judgments. I think the words due regard are very important because that does not equate to absolute deference to whatever finding the trial court or post-conviction court in this case may have made. And I believe it also, put in light of the Court of Appeals decision, has relevance in that I think the Court of Appeals was relying on the fact that Judge Borowski wasn't present during trial proceedings, jury trial proceedings, wasn't present during the sentencing. He even wasn't present during the prolonged proceedings to determine that Mr. Smith is not competent to assist his post-conviction counsel. Those proceedings went on the better part of a year after the conviction. He came into it only after that point when post-conviction counsel for Mr. Smith, that's me, I filed the post-conviction motion seeking the relief that I'm asking this court to essentially grant today. Aside from the statute, there's another standard. I guess I'll refer to it as the Gibson standard based on the case I cite in my brief. And that standard is a little bit slippery, but it basically says that a reviewing court can find a finding of fact to be clearly erroneous even if there's some evidence to support it, as long as, viewing the whole of the evidence, the court is left with a firm conviction that an error was made. And this Gibson standard is basically quoted in paragraph 19 of the Court of Appeals decision. They don't cite Gibson, they cite, I forget the name of it, I believe it's Doring versus a funeral home. But that Gibson standard has carried through from its origins in that 1948 United States Supreme Court case to the present. And I believe that helps clarify that, first of all, there doesn't have to be a complete absence of evidence on one side of the issue in order to find a factual finding clearly erroneous.
Counselor, I'm intrigued by something Justice Ziegler asked a while ago, which was not the way I felt about it before I heard her question. And, of course, since I heard her question, I've been trying to figure it out a little bit further. And she basically asked whether some findings in regard to competency may be factual, but the ultimate determination would be a question of law. And then I've been kind of looking through Garfoot, trying to find it, because I thought it was very helpful. And it isn't particularly straightforward, but it does say, and I quote, although the court must ultimately apply a legal test, okay, its determination is functionally a factual one. Either the state has convinced the court that the defendant has the skills and abilities to be considered competent, or he has not. And so, in a way, it sounds almost like a little bit of a constitutional fact, you know, where we say it's factual, but to meet it, there is a legal component of meeting that standard. If you understand my confused narration and can straighten me out a little bit, I would be very appreciative.
Well, it's definitely a question of constitutional fact in that a person tried while lacking in competency, has been subjected to a due process violation, and I believe I cited a federal circuit court case that said as much. So it is hard to separate and just simply call this a factual finding that the person is competent or is not competent, partially because of this constitutional dimension and partially because it has to be an ultimate conclusion of fact, if that's what it is, an ultimate conclusion in any event that's based on numerous underlying facts that were found.
How would you separate out the parts that are purely factual from the rest of the determination on competence, if it's got this kind of dual nature?
Well, I think part of it is, I think you have to look at where facts come into conflict. When they're undisputed, they're factual findings. For example, the state's first claim is that the court engaged in fact-finding, and they point to paragraph 25 of the Court of Appeals decision, and what the court does in that, as I read that paragraph, is simply state historical facts that there were records that indicated that while Mr. Smith was in the jail, he was having psychotic problems and mental health problems, and that's not really disputed anywhere. No one came in and said, no, the jail records don't say that. They say something else. It's an undisputed fact, and it can be accepted as a simple factual finding. It has no legal consequence in and of itself, as opposed to the ultimate conclusion that a person is or is not competent. And I think that...
But in so doing, isn't the Court of Appeals then just picking which facts it finds more persuasive?
Ultimately, to a degree it is, yes. And I agree in particular with the word you used, persuasive, as opposed to credible, because I don't think that credibility findings played a big part in this. I'm not arguing that Mr. Sargent, trial counsel, was lying or being dishonest when he said, I didn't notice a problem. And in fact, he did concede noting problems. He just didn't categorize them as mental health problems. He said, yes, I knew he had an anger issue, and I knew that when it came to discussing sexual matters, he was rather guarded, and I knew that there were problems regarding alcohol use at the time of the offense. But none of these amounted to him to being competency problems, and I can accept that. But that sort of evidence, which is pretty much primarily or exclusively what Judge Borowski relies on, is really sort of the absence of evidence or the failure to perceive. And against that is the testimony of two expert witnesses who met with Mr. Smith and looked through his records with the particular question in their minds, was this person competent at the time of trial and sentencing? And they were focused on that, and they were unanimous in their conclusion that Mr. Smith was not competent when he was tried or when he was sentenced. And part of that was based on the allocution, which is quoted nearly in full, if not in full, in the Court of Appeals decision. And
they drew an inference from that, didn't they?
Certainly.
You mean at sentencing?
I mean the allocution, the statement made by Mr. Smith personally at sentencing.
Okay, so October 12 to 14, 2009, the case is tried to a jury. October 14 of 2009, the jury returns the verdict of guilty. He is not sentenced until December. The whole notion of competency is that it comes and goes. And even if someone is found incompetent, if they are given if the judge signs off on the form and they're given the treatment, the logic behind it incompetency determination in that regard is that the person will regain competency. It comes and goes sometimes for defendants who are even found incompetent. So how do you know that October 12 through 14 when the lawyer is looking to him for help and he's passing papers back and forth and he's assisting in selecting the jury and assisting in the defense, that looking at jail records where he's acting up and having other issues, how do you know Judge Borowski was wrong to rely on what the trial lawyer said went on, and the trial judge didn't seem to raise any issues regarding competency either? I mean, why is Judge Borowski so wrong to have, and then, you know, I know they cited to the sentencing transcript, but that's 2 months after the trial.
It is, Your Honor.
So is your argument that he wasn't competent at sentencing or trial or both?
Definitely both. And the reason for that is twofold. First of all, the records that the two expert witnesses looked through were records from the jail. Mr. Smith was in jail from January until December of 2009, virtually that whole calendar year. And as early as March, there were notes in the records. He's having psychotic episodes. He's having problems. There was one note that he lost it after being told to take his pants out of his socks. He was, and some of these that I cited in my brief were very close in proximity in time to the time of the trial, and they were consistent with what was exhibited on December 11th in the allocution. The other point you made, Your Honor, is that competency comes and goes. It doesn't seem to be the case with Mr. Smith, because when I first raised competence, it was I raised the question, is he competent to help me now in post-conviction proceedings? And he had three separate evaluations throughout 2010, and each one of those found him to be not competent. There were hearings, evidentiary hearings after two of those, and each one of those resulted in findings that he was not competent to assist in post-conviction proceedings. And finally, the post-conviction court, who was Judge Conan at the time, appointed Attorney Scott Phillips to act as guardian ad litem to make the decision whether I could be authorized to proceed, because I couldn't get a competent opinion from my client whether he'd want to reopen this and the risks that might entail.
And that was the judge that presided over the trial, right?
That was the judge that presided over the trial.
So do you think Judge Borowski was at all do you just think he was dead wrong to say, you know, look, we have the trial judge here who didn't seem to notice anything either? But that's the same judge who later determined that he was incompetent to proceed. Judge Conan must have noticed something different in the meantime, right?
Well, Judge Conan had the benefit of expert testimony in the post-conviction proceedings to help him reach the decision that Mr. Smith was not competent to assist his attorney in post-conviction proceedings. There was no expert testimony at the time of trial or at the time of sentencing. No one raised the issue. That's what I think is the most remarkable fact about this whole case. And it does raise questions about what Mr. Sargent was thinking or wasn't thinking or was perceiving or wasn't perceiving. And the same perhaps for Judge Conan, who sat through proceedings and viewed Mr. Smith, although Mr. Smith never testified.
He had quite a colloquy, actually, with the court about whether he was going to testify and whether he was not going to testify, correct?
He did have some short colloquies about a number of issues that were pointed out, and I believe those are all quoted in the state's petition or state's brief.
Yeah, I think you're right. Would you agree that people can have mental issues, anger management issues, other mental problems, and still be competent to proceed in regard to going to trial and understanding and assisting in the trial?
Certainly, I can't say this person has a mental illness and therefore, for that sole reason, this person's incompetent. That simply isn't true. It is, and Judge Borowski was correct in this much, a judicial standard that's applied. The expert witnesses might apply or might view someone in terms of a medical type of diagnosis. The judge's job is to determine the standard under 971.13, which says a person shall not be tried if he's unable to assist in his defense or to understand the roles of the parties in the court. I'm paraphrasing very crudely. So my argument is not simply because he had a mental illness he was incompetent, but he was definitely incompetent through 2010 and until 2011, based on expert testimony and two evidentiary hearings and findings. And the real question, the real factual question, if you will, is did that happen? Did he become incompetent only after he was tried and sentenced? Or was he incompetent at the time of his trial or sentencing? And I think that the expert testimony in this case found overwhelmingly in favor of a finding that he was not competent at the time of trial or sentencing.
Whose burden was it? It looked to me like you took on the burden at the hearing in front of Judge Borowski. No?
I did, and that's because at least under one of the three theories I was pursuing, which is the substantive claim, I took on the burden of proving that Mr. Smith was not competent, and I could do that without having any burden to prove that trial counsel or the court or anybody else was at fault or that there was even any state actor at fault. If he was tried, and I proved by a preponderance of the evidence that at the time he was tried, then that he was not competent, I proved a due process violation, and the conviction cannot stand.
In paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals opinion, it indicates that if a competency concern is raised by a defendant, the state bears the burden of proving competency by a greater weight of credible evidence. Is that your understanding of the law? And they say C. Garfoot 207 was second, 221, 222.
That's my understanding, and I think that's based on the statute more than the statute's cited right before that, 97114, which is a very lengthy statute and sets out a hearing procedure.
With regard to standard of review, in paragraph, I think it is, 23, the Court of Appeals indicates that the standard of review, and this picks up your earlier reference to paragraph 19 of the Court of Appeals opinion when you cite that, is it a funeral home case or something? At any rate, that the standard of review is whether the whole record reveals a reason to doubt Smith's competence at trial and sentencing, and then goes on to say in the next sentence, the post-conviction court was not the same court who observed Smith at trial and sentencing, and therefore the deference accorded the trial court's competence assessment in Garfoot and Berg doesn't apply to post-conviction. That makes at least intuitive sense to me. Is that the legally correct standard that they're citing, however? I mean, it makes intuitive sense that we can look at the record as well as another judge who looks at the written record.
Right.
That when you're talking about a trial judge who hears, who sees, who feels, maybe that's different. In other words, the pulse of what's going on. But when you're talking about according deference, the post-conviction courts not do the same as when that you might give to the trial court.
Well, put in a common sense way, Judge Borowski couldn't, and I don't think he did, say, oh, based on what I saw at the trial, how he looked at trial, how he looked at sentencing, I'm factoring that in because he didn't see it. He can read the same words we can. Now, Ms. Remington, I'm sure, will point out if I don't, Judge Borowski heard the testimony, and when it comes to evaluating credibility, to the extent he did do that, and I'm arguing really he didn't, he simply went with what he thought was more persuasive without discounting either any testimony as being dishonest or being wrong.
Yeah, but he heard the testimony after the fact, going back to the relating back to the events when the competency was at issue.
There was never
the trial and sentencing is when the competency was at issue.
He presided over a retrospective determination of competency.
Well, we had, unless I'm misunderstanding, we had two areas that we have competency raised. It was raised post-conviction,
And there was a determination he wasn't able to assist his post-conviction counsel, correct?
Correct.
And it was after that was learned that he was impaired there that there was then a request to order a new trial based on a determination that he was not competent at trial to be tried, correct?
Correct.
And it was that second determination of competency that Judge Borowski presided over, correct?
Correct.
Who presided over the one that occurred initially, the post-sentencing one? Which judge? Do you know, was it Jean D'Amato?
I want to say, I know she presided at the middle finding where chronologically there was a report and a hearing, and I'm at a loss to say if that was Judge D'Amato or what that was Judge Conan. But then I know it came up again and for a three-month review, and there was a report saying he hadn't regained competency, and based on that, it was just put over for some more months until a third report was generated and a second hearing was held.
If that helps at all, the end of June, Judge Conan ordered the competency evaluation, September 3, 13, 2010. There was Judge D'Amato's competency hearing where she found him incompetent to participate in post-conviction proceedings. Then you have the every three-month reports that came in. And then March 31, 2011, Judge Conan held the competency hearing and found him incompetent to assist and not likely to regain competency. And then October 14, 2011, is when Judge Borowski had the hearing on Turn Back the Hands of Time. Back in 2009, was he competent at trial?
Correct.
Does that help?
And I did request a competency hearing. I believed that one could be done that would be meaningful. In the Pate case, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, they found a different remedy. They were looking at a record where, during the course of a trial where there was what we would call an NGI defense, there were also references made to the person's current sanity, and the court in Pate said, well, based on this, there should have been a competency hearing. Now we, the U.S. Supreme Court, are looking at this, I believe, 6 years later, and there's no way to reconstruct it, so we're dismissing it. But the courts after Pate have favored doing a competency determination retrospectively where that can be meaningfully done, and I believe it could be in this case, and it was in this case, and that the evidence presented was overwhelmingly in favor of a finding that he was not competent at trial or sentencing.
Counsel, I have a difficult time parsing the former cases, the Court of Appeals, and the briefs in determining what appears to me, which may not be, but appears to me, two standards of review, clearly erroneous and erroneous exercise of discretion. And you tried to piece them together. So here's my question to you. If we were going to start again and not be bound by whatever we said about the standard of review before, what standard of review would you suggest for an appellate court to review a trial court's decision, a circuit court's decision, where the circuit court decides competency? Now, it could be decides competency, 2 days after the trial or 5 years after the trial, retrospective.
Well, I don't think that both standards will be implicated in every case like this, if there are any cases like this. But I would suggest starting with the erroneous exercise of discretion standard because, at least as I argue, it is based on an erroneous view of the law. That is that if you follow Judge Borowski's reasoning and accept categorically testimony of people who were present at trial and sentencing and rejecting those who weren't, and if there's any other basis for how he parsed these witnesses, I can't determine from the record what that is. Then the court can make a practical, legal determination based on did Judge Borowski properly follow the law, which allows for retrospective determinations of competency under Johnson. I believe if the court finds can go on to the second standard if, only if it, it fails to find an erroneous exercise of discretion, and then they, the court can then go to the clearly erroneous standard, which is more fact-based and does require a view of the entire record. And it does, I think, when the court, the state raised their second issue about weighing, I think it's, when you look at the standards set forth and for what is clearly erroneous mean, there is a degree of weighing in there, and there's no escaping that. That doesn't mean that a reviewing court can simply substitute and view everything de novo and say, I call it this way. I think the court has to say whether, determine whether, looking at the whole record, the court's firmly convinced that an error was made by the post-conviction court. I believe that a fair reading of the, what the Court of Appeals did is so fine, and I'm asking this court to so fine.
Anything about the Court of Appeals that you would change?
I agree that the language they used, that there was reason to doubt competency, is not as clear. I believe
that's been the last paragraph of the opinion that you're talking about.
I believe paragraph so. 26. I know it was referred to in the questioning of Ms. Remington.
Here, the expert's reports, blah, 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 furnish ample evidence that there is reason to doubt Smith's competence.
I believe
If I were given the pen to change that,
I would say there is ample proof that Smith was not competent by a preponderance of the evidence and that the court's finding to the contrary was clearly erroneous.
Is the defendant competent now?
Well, there have been no further proceedings on his competency. I know that he's been transferred to Columbia Correctional, but I don't know what criteria the Department of Corrections uses to decide whether a person with mental health problems, where a person with mental health problems should be housed. So,
if you prevail, what happens?
The conviction and sentence are vacated. If the case is remanded for a new trial, if incompetent at that time, I imagine that that would be the first court question for the court on remand to determine: is this person competent now to stand trial or not? If so, trial will proceed. If the person is not competent, then the statute does provide for, ultimately, for a person who's not never likely to regain competency, there is a civil commitment provision referred to.
Thank you.
May I ask one?
Sure.
If you looked at the transcript of the trial itself, as opposed to sentencing, is there anything in that transcript that you would point to as demonstrating that the defendant was not competent?
If I'm limited to the transcript of the trial, he has the short yes-no colloquies that really don't tell us much of anything, and that was the opinion of the experts. He said when he speaks in an open-ended scenario such as allocution where he's allowed to spew forth, Mr. Smith's condition is clear. When you ask him yes-no questions and you get yes-no answers, it's not so clear. So if the review is limited to the trial court transcript, there's not much to go on either way because Mr. Smith doesn't testify. And the issue simply wasn't raised.
Well, do you consider the sentencing part of the trial transcript?
Certainly part of the trial court proceedings. I don't know if after the adjudication on the guilt, but it's part of what's required for a judgment, so yes.
But in a short time, relatively short time of the trial, and as I read his comments, they were very difficult to follow, very difficult to understand, not responding to the questions. Both the court and his counsel attempted to direct his thinking and speech to what was at issue, which raises the question of whether he really could help his lawyer and deal with this.
I agree.
Do you disagree with that?
I agree entirely, and I think it shows, too, how trial counsel and the trial court at sentencing, even when confronted with this, are focused on the agenda of this is a sentencing, and we've heard sentencing arguments, and we've heard from the victim, and now we're hearing from the defendant, and the next step is deciding the sentence. And I think that gave Mr. Sargent and Judge Conan perhaps a bit of tunnel vision where they didn't say, whoa, let's stop here. Is this a mental health situation? Is this person competent?
Thank you.
Thank you.
To first address the question Justice Ziegler asked me near the end of my presentation about who had the burden at the post-conviction hearing, the defendant did have the burden, and I think oftentimes in competency evaluations, the burden is placed on the state under 971.14, but in this case, because it wasn't determining the defendant's competency to proceed, it was determining his competency at a prior point, I believe that the burden was properly placed on the defendant, although in this case, I'm not sure it mattered who was calling the witnesses, but it didn't seem to factor into the circuit court's actual conclusion. It was just concluding if he was above the line of competency or below the line of competency. It more related to who ended up calling the witnesses to testify. But 971.14 does not apply in situations like this because that's more determining going forward, can the defendant proceed?
What do you think of defendants saying that the first thing we should do, or any appellate court should do, is determine whether or not there was a correct application of the law, and here it wasn't because he categorically just listened to the people that were at trial and not the experts. And you can't do that categorically. You have to pay attention to everybody.
Well, the state disputes that that's what the circuit court did in this case. The circuit court listened to the experts and questioned each expert and talked to them and did not reject their conclusions solely because they didn't talk to the defendant at the time of trial. Instead, it took those conclusions with a grain of salt and said, okay, I'm going to take this conclusion. I'm going to weigh that with Mr. Sargent's testimony that this person did understand me. And that's the case. As far as the standard of review, the clearly erroneous and erroneous exercise of discretion, it appears that in Garfoot, this court uses those two standards interchangeably and talks about how it's a factual determination, but says it's either clearly erroneous or an erroneous exercise of discretion. In Berge, there's a little more, the language is honed a little more and talks about whether it's whether the decision is clearly erroneous and does not talk as much about the whether the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion. But it seems to me, and this is reflected in my briefs as well, that there's a little bit of inartful language used in the decisions, and it should, I believe that this court should make it clear that it's a clearly erroneous standard that the courts apply and take away.
And
it is a fact. That was addressed directly in Berge. In Garfoot, this court talked about the standard review, but the parties didn't brief, but acknowledged that it was the clearly erroneous standard. In Berge, this court took on that issue, and both parties briefed it and concluded that it's not a question of constitutional fact where facts are reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard and the legal conclusion is reviewed de novo. It rejected that in Berge and determined that it's all a factual determination and that the clearly erroneous standard applies.
Thank you very much for clearing that up.
You're welcome. The state asked.
I ask one other question. Opposing counsel addressed this. Not every person who has a mental illness lacks competency to proceed at trial. In fact, we understand that a very large percentage of people in correctional institutions have mental illness problems. How would you define what distinguishes incompetency to proceed from mental illness?
Based on this court's precedent and the U.S. Supreme Court precedent, the difference is this, the understand and assist test. It's not whether the
understand.
Understand and assist. It's not whether the person has a mental illness, because, as you said, many people in the criminal justice system have a mental illness. The question is whether the defendant is able to understand the proceedings and assist their counsel in their defense. And that is the standard that should be used to determine whether the mental illness rises to a level of incompetence to proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for very, very good arguments. You read these briefs and you think about them and you think you know what you think, and then you come in and hear something else. It's very helpful. It was a very good argument, so thank you. The court is going to conclude for the day, but we will meet in closed conference at 3:10. Thank you. We are adjourned.